Herman?
Wednesday night, the 26th here. We are setting aside until probably next Wednesday due to further amendments coming. It would be Senate Bill 615, Senate Bill 1187, and Senate Bill 882. Do we? Well, now, hold on. 1187, no. 1187 isn't included in that list. I think it's 87, yeah, that's included in that list. Okay.
All right.
Yep. Yeah, half your agenda's gone. Well, let's start with the testimony on Senate Bill 1187.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 1187, A in growth, exempts lands for which exception is taken from land use planning goals, protecting farmland and forest land from land use planning goals related to urbanization, regulating urbanization. I'll get that. There's a vote sheet in your packet and a revenue and fiscal impact, indicating a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, let's have a look at our sponsor. Here's Tino with Request of Association Real Truth of Joy Schnitt. Come on. And whoever he invites.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. With me is Matt Farmer, legal counsel for Oregon Association of Realtors. I brought him along for maybe some specific questions the committee might have regarding the lawsuit that this affects. This bill is basically a genesis of Curry County versus 1,000 Friends. It was a lawsuit brought in the late 80s. The issue at the time was we were going through our planning system and on exception lands, and what had happened was Curry County had approved, and LCD has also approved, the exceptions process and identified in the comprehensive plan review. The Court of Appeals, the 1,000 Friends then filed a suit. The Court of Appeals upheld it. Supreme Court reversed it. And it's a fairly complex legal case. There's probably over 100 pages in the legal opinion. I certainly am not an expert, so I did bring Matt with me to try and help you if you have some questions regarding that. The bill, as it sits, tries to do one simple change, and that's to move the land use process back to local control. what has happened since the late 80s and the lawsuit, those exception lands have kind of remained in a limbo area because it's very difficult to understand how Goal 14, which is the goal that covers urbanization, applies to the exceptions process, since urbanizing land is not out in the rural areas. They're not in the exceptions lands. So what we sought to do is merely correct that assumption that was reversed in the Supreme Court decision and go back to the original way that we always approached that. When we have these lands that are committed out in the rural areas that are neither farm nor forest lands but are committed for other uses, that we allow the flexibility for local government to come into those areas and plan and zone and do the other things that the planning system requires them to do. When they're going through this process, they have to comply with all the rest of the goals. This bill does nothing about applying with goals 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So what I'm trying to assure the committee here is this doesn't turn the system upside down. What it does do, however, is move those planning stations back to the local level and get it out of the state LCD departments to get it back to local planning departments to try and coordinate these exception areas. You'll hear testimony, I'm sure, from a lot of folks. I have chats with various interest groups that feel that they're affected somehow or another. We had some discussion earlier on with Metro. They were concerned that this might affect the urban reserve issue. It will not. Urban reserve is under a separate legal authority that will not affect urban reserves. Farm Bureau had some concerns about will this cause some problems so far as the interface between those exception lands and prime farmlands. Well, I guess if you have one more house in the rural area, I guess you could say that it may affect the total situation. However, if you're not allowing construction in exception lands and you're not allowing it in the resource lands, but you are allowing it in the urban areas, I think we have a problem here. What we're trying to do is make the system work. We're trying to use those lands that are already committed and already have other uses on them. What I gave for an example on the other side, Senator Corcoran had brought up the issue that he had in his county where they had an abandoned mill site. And the mill was already committed. It had a parking lot. It had utilities. It had other facilities to it. When this mill closed down, the present law wouldn't allow them to zone that property commercial and allow for another light industrial purpose to go in out in the rural lands. I think it's quite appropriate for local government to look at those issues and see if there are some things that are compatible. I did hear comments from other groups that said, well, if we allow this, what stops the Weremarts, the other large box manufacturers from locating out in the rural lands? Well, I guess our planning system would hold that up. I don't think we're going to be locating Weremarts on abandoned mill sites or Costco's or some of the other large facilities that we're talking about here. I guess I have a lot more faith in local government, and I believe that local government is the proper place to do the local planning activities, and that's where it should be, and I hope by this simple bill, that's what I'm trying to do, is move those issues back to local government. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll answer any questions the committee might have, or our legal counsel is here to answer some questions if you have specific legal questions there.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Devlin? Exception lands, I know, are an issue in areas other than the metropolitan area, in addition to the metropolitan area. But I think one of the reactions that you would get is that, remember the numbers that have been published recently, I think there's something in the neighborhood of 100,000 acres of exception lands outside of the three-county metropolitan area, within those three counties directly, in many cases, surrounding the boundary, which is an area of land equivalent to probably more than a third of what's inside the boundary. If you did what was contemplated in this bill, and far more development occurred in those areas, how would you ever begin to accommodate the needs that would arise from that development when, particularly like Clackamas County, that has about 70,000 acres of that 100,000 plus acres of exception land, now doesn't really know how it's going to accommodate the urban reserves that have been designated by Metro within its boundary to provide services to them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devin, I'm Matt Farmer for the Oregon Association of Realtors. The answer to that is that those exception areas are subject to Oregon's land use planning. It would be the same as asking how Metro intends to provide adequate facilities for the growth that is being directed inside their metropolitan growth boundary. The answer is that they're doing the best they can. What has happened after the Curry County case is that those types of decisions have been moved up to the state level, which frankly does not have, I don't think they would necessarily have the authority to make those kind of decisions, and I don't think it's necessarily consistent with where our land use system started out, which was local control, decision-making of zoning, which is the particular use on the particular site, subject to state goals and supervision as to whether those goals are made. An example of what has happened is that unincorporated cities, which are not subject to urbanization standards, to Goal 14, because they're not incorporated, are in limbo. And so whole new administrative rules have been developed to try and accomplish something like urban growth boundaries around unincorporated areas, which means that the planning level has moved up. So an answer to your question is development must be appropriate and staged appropriately in a county no less than in an urban area under our land use planning system.
Yes, Chairman.
That they've done.
But in this particular case, this bill specifically exempts them from the urbanization goal. So, and they're already exempted from ag and forestry goals because it's exception land.
Representative.
What would the content of their review be?
There are goals that speak to facilities development, Goal 11, for example. And, of course, they're still subject to that. They are also, I mean, this idea that somehow once the state bureaucracy lets go, everyone will run wild, I think is, could bear some examination as well, because, of course, they're still subject to elected officials' review of planning.
Well, there, Mr. Chairman, there are some people that remember the history and to some extent, but the reason there are so many exception lands in Clackamas County is that they approved probably far more exceptions than they should have until such time as the state clamped down on them granting more exceptions, and that's why we have 70,000 acres of exception lands in the county.
Well, Chairman Walsh, Representative Devin, I don't know that we can go back and relive how well counties did at the initial taking of exceptions, but I should point out that, that this particular case that we're dealing with, the Curry County, it's actually Curry County versus, or it was actually 1,000 Friends versus the Land Conservation and Development Commission, which had approved Curry County's plan to use these exception areas in a reasonable way, to basically zone them for intelligent uses, and that was approved by LCDC. And it was only at the Supreme Court level that the link between what are obviously not rural lands or not urban lands was made with an urban goal. Before that, you just took exceptions to the goals that applied, and no one imagined that a goal specifically directed towards incorporated urban areas would be applied to what are obviously not incorporated cities. It's when that connection was made that basically stop local people from deciding what to do with areas that are, by everyone's admission, not farm or forest land.
Mr. Chairman, to put it on my call, I guess one of the difficulties I have sometimes in the process is a lot of times we do have, and so I missed your testimony about the situation in Perry County, and I put that, is that we have tried to pass a state law that addresses perhaps a problem that's been located in one area, but in reality we're passing a state law that will apply to the entire state. And so I think I have to look at the entire ramifications for the state and use planning system, not just the implications for the situation for the time.
Representative Devlin, and I couldn't agree more, and this is an instance where this is exactly the intent I want to do, is move this issue back into local government, because local government is the best suited person to organize and define these criteria. For instance, I serve also in a tax increment financing district in government camp. It is one of these urban unincorporated areas in Clackamas County that you had mentioned. We've entered negotiations with the county and LCEC to try and define our community boundaries. We are not an incorporated area. We are one of these, quote, unincorporated areas that have been dealt with by LCD to try and define some parameters about how we can grow and what we can do. The difficulty of trying to pass regulations at the state level is that we are a unique community. We are a ski area. And we are trying to develop up there to a level that the citizens enjoy and in some type of controlled atmosphere. The difficulty is that the definitions LCD comes up with doesn't fit our criteria. And for instance, they have a moratorium or a limit, an upper limit on the size of buildings you can create in town. That's the intent was to try and keep Walmarts from located in unincorporated areas, I'm sure. But the problem is that the limitation also affects ski lodges. And we can't build ski lodges because we can't fit the definition. If we move to another category, then we can't build motels. Well, what do people come to government camp for? There's a ski and recreation. If we can't get motels, then obviously this doesn't fit our definition. It's not an overwhelming problem. We'll eventually get to the end of it. But the point I'm trying to make is I think these situations could be resolved rather easily at the local level. It's very difficult when it reaches up to the state level because the situations are all unique. So the situation in Clackamas County might be different than the one in Jackson County, which might be different from the one in Lincoln County or Clatsop County. So, again, that's why our land use system is set up so that we have local government controlling it because they can react to the local situation. And this intent is to do just that, is to change this from a statewide control issue back to local government and the local government work. Now, the fear that maybe we have, and I've seen these figures, and I frankly don't know which one's right, whether it's 100,000, 700,000, or whatever the acreage is, I guess the fear is that these could be developed to whatever extent, and pretty soon we would have cities the size of Portland located everywhere. Now, I guess that's assuming that our planning system doesn't work, and in fact that the development would go rampant just as soon as we start dealing with these succession areas. I don't think so. I mean, I frankly do not think that local governments would go nuts and create havoc out there in the hinterlands. And if we don't get to this issue and somehow resolve it, the pressure is going to continue on the farmlands, and the resource lands are going to suffer because people want to locate somewhere. So can we locate them on some other areas other than prime and forest land and prime ag lands? These lands are already identified and they're already committed. Maybe we could focus some of this pressure somewhere other than where we don't want it, and that's on our prime farm and forest land. So that's the intent, and the intent is to do this at the local level. And I think it's a good bill. I think it'll work. And I guess it's just my faith that I think the system will function if you give it the right tools and you give it to the right person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schmidt, my concern is that we do have all session long people coming before us asking for legislation statewide because they feel that their county planning system hasn't hasn't done it by the rules and haven't done the right thing. I refer again to the issue of annexation, which is not something we're talking about here, but my staunchest land use supporters now want to be able to vote on annexation. When I ask them why, they say it's because our county planners and our county commission are not abiding by the rules. And so we do have that approach to us. And now we have an approach that would ask us to reverse a Supreme Court decision. And I guess I just have to resist both of those. As painful as it is to work through the process, I really do believe in the process. And I am anxious to hear from the agency to see if they can clarify in any way what their role has been and whether we can give any relief to the situation you're talking about. But I share the misgivings that Representative Devlin stated, that we may be doing statewide what you consider to be a good thing, but I would see it as a weakening of some of our roles and an opportunity for more divisive kind of arguments on the local level than we have now, which are considerable in my district.
Representative Taylor, Chair Welsh, I agree, and it is a very contentious argument there, and it's getting more contentious. Part of the issues is the urban issues. I mean, we've got people now that we're concentrating to greater and greater densities with inside the urban growth boundaries. I get just as many complaints now from realtors that deal with urban properties saying, this is nuts. Why are you putting me stacked in here on top of everybody else? And I didn't buy in this neighborhood to live with light industry in here and stores above me and below me, and this isn't the kind of neighborhood I want to live in. However, some of our planning systems, that's exactly where we're focused, and we prefer focus to either we live in a high density urban setting or we live in a rural setting in commercial farmland. There's no in between, and there ought to be some avenues here where we can allow the system to function at a controlled rate and in compliance with all the rest of the goals. And I share your concern. I know I get the same issues that you get. I don't know the answer, but I know the answer doesn't lie here in Salem. The answer lies with local government. And so if we can empower local government to deal with most of these issues, we're going to be a lot better off. And as much as I can do to help that system work and allow local government to come up with some of these solutions, I think the better off we will be. I don't have all the solutions. I guess I'm here to, quote, get the land use system that this bill has been caused. It came out of committee 4-1 on the other side. Senator Shannon was hesitant for her support. She did later say she was going to vote for the bill. However, she was missing at the time it went into session. It was a close vote, 16-13. It wasn't overwhelming. But I know that the concerns that you're speaking about and Representative Devlin, and you'll hear from a host of other folks with some concerns here about the control issue. I'm still adamant. I still believe strongly that the control doesn't belong here at LCD. The issue belongs to local government, and that's my point.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Bob Lindy and Jim John.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Senate Bill 1187 applies to about 750,000 acres of land in rural Oregon outside urban growth boundaries. So the main point I want to make here is that this is not a minor adjustment in spite of what some have said. This affects in a major way the Oregon land use system. The 750,000 acres are dispersed throughout farmland, forest land, tend to be within commuting distance or right up against urban growth boundaries, but there are all over the state. The urbanization goals and how they apply to rural lands was something that was disputed for a number of years. I want to clarify the court case situation on this. Yes, LCDC lost that case. We approved the Curry County plan. That was appealed ultimately to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court overturned our approval.
Mr. Chair, could you back up and give us some background about what the issues were in the case?
That's what I was just going to do. Thank you, Ms. Senator Morgan. The case was about how whether Curry County had adequately addressed Goal 14, the urbanization goals, and in their land use plan for the exception areas that are in Curry County. LCDC believed they had adequately addressed those lands. Thousand Friends didn't think they had, and Curry County also thought they had addressed those lands. So LCDC stood with Curry County in that court case, arguing that the county had done a good enough job.
When you say address these lands, are you talking about justifying the exemption for them, the exception, rather?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, no, the question is this. When a county takes exception to land from Goals 3 and 4, they're essentially making the case that that land is not suitable for farmland or for forest land, usually because of development that's already there. And in the case of the 400-plus rural communities that we were talking about, that's quite obvious. For the larger lot development interspersed throughout farmland, which probably comprises the bulk of exception lands, that issue was quite contentious. Nevertheless, once a county has, let's say that we all agree for all those lands, and we did ultimately, for 750,000 acres, we all agreed that's not farmland, that's not forest land. The next question is, how should it be zoned? Should there be any limits on the development in that land? Goal 14 provides limits. It requires that those be rural uses. And there's good reason for that. This land, as I said, is interspersed among the farm areas. Most of those landowners, when they applied to the county for exceptions, were very content with rural zoning. It might be 1 acre, 2 acre, 5 acre zoning. That's what most of this land is. If that land is zoned to allow higher density subdivisions, as you see in cities, you're going to have to run sewer and water systems to that land, apartments or stores or whatever uses you have, all of those become a much greater conflict with farmland. And therefore, the question about whether Goal 14 applies has very large implications with respect to the viability of our farm and forest zones. Moreover, it has a great deal of effect just on our urban growth boundaries and how they function in the first place. Urban growth boundaries were established as the places where we want to provide for urban uses. We require cities, 240 cities statewide, we have required throughout this process that cities set aside land for development, plan for services for that development, sewer systems, water systems, police, etc. We can't do that for the 750,000 acres of rural land. We can't afford to serve those areas, provide the roads and the services to those areas. The question about whether the existing communities are in limbo is one that I also want to address carefully here. The counties came to LCDC in 1990 or 1991, 1992, somewhere in there, talking about the fact that LCDC had no rules for rural communities, 400 potential communities throughout the state, many of which look just like cities, Pacific City, Green, White City. And proposed rules, we put together a committee of many interests and reached agreement on rules, adopted rules for rural communities that have been in place now for a number of years. Those are working well. Counties are not coming to us and saying, even though we liked them then, we don't like them now. But if this bill passes, the entire basis of those rules and all the planning that counties have done for our rural communities throughout the state the underpinning goes away. That's a, if nothing else, there's a legal limbo that we create. Because we now have a set of rules that where what's planning has taken place, and those rules are gone. I don't know what happens to that planning. Same question with urban reserve areas. Counties and cities asked us to write urban reserve rules. We agreed. We wrote them. We had broad agreement on those rules. As you know, we've done some urban reserve planning. Certainly Metro has spent years trying to create urban reserves and is now most of the way there. But the entire underpinning of those rules is the urbanization goals. And the lands included in those urban reserves are exceptions lands, most of the lands in those, that would be affected by this law. So the legal implications, I think, are not well thought out. We don't know the answers, and I think we're going to have years of litigation over what is the effect of this bill on a lot of planning that's taken place in the last few years. Exceptions lands are developed, and they continue to develop. A lot of development occurs in exception lands. I take issue with Mr. Schmidt's comments when he talks about not allowing construction. If we don't allow construction in rural areas, we're only allowed in the cities, we can't have it. But we have a lot of construction in rural areas, in communities, and exception lands. What the Curry County case did is put some limits on the intensity of that. The Curry County case did not put those decisions in LCDC's lap. The Curry County case stated simply that if a county decides they want to rezone or to zone those lands to allow urban uses, intensive uses, they must take an exception. And those exceptions have been granted or approved, but in general, counties haven't sought those exceptions. There was a few years where the communities arguably needed those exceptions. We took care of that with the community rules. So I think in the long run, this is an area of planning that has worked. We have 15 years now since that court case. We have put a lot of effort, local and state effort, with great agreement on trying to resolve the issues of that case. We haven't defined urban uses primarily because our position on that has, we've told counties over and over, as soon as we define those, we are making the standard. At this point, as an undefined term, the counties make that decision. Most of the planning, most of the decisions about what happens to exception areas are now in the county's hands. And all this bill does is take away all the state rules for all those rural exception lands. And for the 400 communities, and many of which are just like cities have a myriad of planning goals. The only goal that really has any effect on rural communities is this one. Why would we just sweep it away? If I could conclude, we urge you not to pass this bill. I think it will create a legal havoc. I don't think there's a problem that is severe out there that it is trying to resolve. And I think the work we have done to date in resolving the issues of the Curry County case is good work with state agreement.
Well, Bob, we did hear that there are some problems. You know, when you go from one extreme to the next, there isn't anything incrementally in between that resolves it.
Mr. Chair, I think that there is a continuum of let's just say density and look at residential land. The continuum starts at farmland, maybe 80 acres, 40 acres, even 20s, and an awful lot of land in rural areas zoned for 10, 5, 1, even half-acre development. From there, you go inside an urban growth boundary, and you'll find land use plans that are authorizing any density, but that have limits. For usually, what an urban residential zone will say is that you can't build more dense than 5 units an acre or 7, but you can develop at anything lower than that, and many developers do. I think if you looked from space at the Oregon landscape, you will see all the in between of the extremes that were described to you. Are there, they're being built, every day. There's nothing we've done that has prevented that.
Questions from Bob? That's in Morgan.
I'm still trying to get my hands around what this is exactly that we're trying to do or not do here. You said that there were a number of things that were, at this point, local decisions, but I'm wondering if you can tell us what the nature of those things are that can be decided at the local level and what it is that the state decides.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I'd be glad to do that. The For exception areas in any county, that county, first of all, made the decision as to which areas to seek exception for and completed that. The county then made decisions as to how to zone those areas. The counties are allowed outright to zone land for what's already there. If there's a mill site, the county can zone it for a mill. No further problem. There's no exception required for a new mill at that site. If that's residential today, it can stay residential. What the Curry County case gets into is if a county decides it wants to allow a more intensive use than the current one. So, for example, for areas that might be zoned for 5 acres, the county might want to upzone that to 2 acres or one. There's some point where, and it's a theoretical point, which we have not defined, where it could be argued that the density, say if it's residential, is urban. At that point, the county has to take an exception. For many areas that we've allowed exceptions on and have completed the process throughout the state, we have densities, as I say, from 1 to 5 acres. That's about standard. When you go more dense than 1 acre, you start to creep into the question about whether it's urban. Certainly, if you allow subdivisions that require sewer and water systems, 5-10 per acre, you're allowing urban use. Where exactly that line is, we don't know. LCDC hasn't stepped in. That's still a local decision. Local government can try and make a reasoned argument as to whether they've now allowed an urban use, and if they have, they take an exception, or whether they think it's still rural. And many counties do that, and therefore they don't need an exception. At any rate, the only way that decision comes to LCDC is if the county does that deciding about density during the periodic review of the county, then those decisions are brought to LCDC for final approval. For those counties that make those decisions outside of periodic review during the normal course of their year planning business, those decisions are never subject to review unless someone takes the decision to leave them.
Any questions?
Representative Welsh, committee members, Jim Johnson, the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I want to zero in and focus on one specific element of the exceptions rules, and I'll step back as this relates to our concerns. In order to approve an exception in farm or forest zones, I'm oversimplifying this, but I want to talk about two primary steps. One, you have to show that it's not farm or forest land. Either it's developed or it's committed or such. Even after you show that, the exception cannot be approved until you go through another review step that says, even though it's not farm or forest land, the development proposed for that exception will not adversely impact surrounding farm or forest land. So if you can't meet that second test, you also cannot approve the exception. So all those 750,000 acres that were described earlier have went through that process and have been found to not only be not farm and forest land, but to also be compatible with the surrounding farm and forest land. Our concern is, let me back up, because they've done that, they've already taken an exception. They've already shown that they don't impact farm and forest land. Goals 3 and 4 no longer apply. Our concern is this bill would basically now accept goal 14 from all those existing exception areas. You can't go back and review against goal 3 and 4 because they've already been accepted. So now you can basically, under the without having the urbanization goal, allow for urban levels of development, urban types of development, commercial and industrial, out there without any review for its impact on surrounding farm and forest lands. And, of course, that's the gist of our concern. An exception area that allows 5-acre lots, which found to be compatible with surrounding farming practices, no goal 14, they could come in and then do 5,000 square foot lots, and that could dramatically change the impact to a surrounding agricultural operation or forest practices. And so that's the crux of our concerns. Thank you.
Okay, questions for Mr. Johnson? Tom Miller?
Out,
We've got that. She can help.
My name is Tom Miller. I'm a certified planner and landscape architect. I'm from Springfield. And I brought this piece of work with me today. It's the current piece of work that I happen to be working on. I'm not looking for approval, obviously, but it seemed to me that aspects of this particular property and this particular project would perhaps help explain this Goal 14 relationship and just some of these other things, certainly that I have heard here today. This is the first time that I have ever been at one of these hearings. So I don't make a practice of it, so I may not be as smooth as some of the other folks. But I do know that there are always hidden agendas, and that you all have heard just this afternoon, as I have heard, things that people wanted to tell you, but not necessarily everything. The main issue behind this bill, or at least behind some of the opposition to this bill, I should say, is a limit of density in the rural area. The definition presently between rural and urban is real clear. If it's served by municipal water and wastewater, it's urban. Curry County project was going to be served by utility. LCDC or 1,000 Friends determined that that was an urban project. I believe that that was right. Anything that's rural then is not provided with municipal water and wastewater. And that's part of the value of this little study. The map that I have here is a 10-acre parcel, 2-acre lots. So each lot would have a single well, a drain field, a replacement area, a nice-sized home, possibly a garage, possibly a shop, possibly a small pasture. All of those kinds of things can work on a 2-acre parcel if it has the proper type of soil. This particular property is adjacent to the Eugene Springfield urban growth boundary, which is along the north of the property line, along a slough. It is not urban reserve, so it exists as rural acreage. The property to your left or to its west is an exception area. It's a developed area of 1-acre lots that were constructed in the early 70s, so they just predated the land use laws. So this particular project would require an amendment to the metro plan that would enable an exception, an inclusion into this adjacent exception area. The property is zoned agriculture right now. It is 20 acres, and we've done some very extensive studies related to the ton and a half of fertilizer that has been applied to this property every year, the pesticides, the fungicides, the herbicides that have been applied. The property exists over a groundwater aquifer plume, which feeds the municipal well field. So there are a lot of things kind of happening that suggest that perhaps this isn't a good agricultural property. The property also was not included in the urban growth boundary when the urban growth boundary was formed for two reasons. One, it's within the 500-year floodway fringe, and then it was agriculture. It's part of an agricultural zone. Again, exception area to its left. To its right, it's zoned agriculture, although there's a 3-acre parcel, a half-acre parcel, a 4-acre parcel, and then another 20-acre agricultural parcel. So again, I just felt like it was a good example that maybe would help put this issue in perspective. I believe the issue is density, rural density versus urban density. Urban density, as the Eugene Springfield Metropolitan Plan requires, is a minimum of 8 units per net acre, which is about 6 units per gross acre. That brings into play other aspects, I think, of state goals. Goal 10, housing, makes it very clear one of the main portions of the goal is the provision of diversity of housing type and choice to the public. And that's not to suggest that everything shouldn't be within an urban growth boundary, but we are seeing a lot of development that's small lot, single family, no yard. And I know, at least from my own experience, because I deal with a lot of people in rural areas, in exception areas, and I handle zone changes. So I'll kind of explain how that works, too, because I think that's important. There are an awful lot of people that need to have a little land. Some people need land for emotional reasons. Some people need land because they work at home. I know people specifically, this is kind of a new thing, but they sell material over the internet and they make products at home. They've outgrown their garage. They need a warehouse. They need a shop to work in. They can't afford to go pay some office space someplace. If they had a parcel like this, 2-acre parcel, they could live at home. They could work at home. They could still do some urban agriculture. It's a choice. It's just simply a choice that people would have. I served on the Mayor's Housing Task Force and also the Residential Lands Task Force for Lane County, Eugene, Springfield Joint Committees for a period of 5 years. And over, one of the things that we talk a lot about low-income housing, special needs housing, those type of things, but we also talk a lot about choice and the fact that it's becoming more and more difficult for people to have choice. Enough of that. Exception areas, 750,000 acres, is that what I heard? Clackamas County must be different than Lane County. I have worked in Lane County for many years, and I don't know of one property in Lane County that's within an exception area that's not developed. I mean, the criteria was that it had to be developed. Some of the property that was not included in exception areas by 1,000 Friends of Oregon in the 1988 lawsuit probably should have been. 1,000 Friends of Oregon had staff in the Lane County facility while they updated their comprehensive plan. There's not a parcel in that county in the 800 exception areas that probably doesn't belong there because it's got a house on it or a business on it or something. There's a lot of property in the county, just like these on this sheet, half acre piece right here, 3 acre, 4 acre. They're not in an exception area. So there was a lot of land in the county that was developed that still wasn't included in exception areas. So for the most part, at least in Lane County, from my experience, the property that is within exception areas is developed. So this proposed bill has no impact on that at all. It's not going to enable anybody to create more exception areas. It only enables you to use the exception areas that you've got. The zoning process. Within this rural area, then, these properties will be zoned R10, R5, or R2. Sometimes it's possible, based upon the average parcel size of all contiguous exception areas, to change zoning from 10 to 5 or from 5 to 2. When we go through that process, we have to address Goal 14, urbanization. We never have anything to say about it. We say Goal 14 doesn't apply because this isn't urban development, because we don't have municipal water and wastewater services here. These are a minimum 2-acre parcels which can function with a separate well, drain field. They all meet the state health requirements and so on. So again, I go back to the issue of density. I think what's really at issue here is that density. Thousand Friends of Oregon wants a minimum parcel density in the state of 10 acres. LCDC published a new rule in January. It was supposed to have been passed in January. It didn't get passed because of opposition. It requires a minimum 5-acre parcel size in rural areas. That's an agenda. They don't just leave it up to the counties. I think that...
can I open it up to questions?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, questions from the committee. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify. The figures that we've heard quoted are about 750,000 acres of reception land statewide. The figures that have been related to me in the past are about 70,000 acres in Clackamas County, or somewhat over 100,000 acres directly surrounding the metropolitan area and the Creek Tri-County area. Just want to clarify.
Representative Morgan.
How do you deal with the issue that was brought up by the Forestry Department of addressing the impact on surrounding resource uses if you're more intensely zoning?
Yes. Good question. And I think a good response is in this document on page 59. It's an exception to the forest zoning. And we've really looked at the past economics, for instance, the type of soil. The type of soil in this case is actually pretty good. But there's development all around the parcel. There's a daycare center across from the parcel. So the dust and the chemicals, those typical kinds of complaints that you hear about, have certainly been complaints here. But the biggest problem is that when I got the economic figures from the state and I applied them to this particular property, I realized that these people never made a dime. These people literally subsisted on this property. It's part of they're part of the Chase family. They had a produce stand on the property. They sold produce every year. The parents converted a portion of their chicken house to chicken coop and lived in the chicken coop. Still had chickens in the other part of the chicken coop. A daughter who really did the farming lived in an old mobile home. Very knowledgeable people. I mean, really knew how to grow their stuff. But when you can only get so much money for corn and zucchini and so on, you know, you can't make it. Her parents died, and she literally had to borrow money to bury her parents. The farmer was in the hole, and she sold it to a developer. So that's part of that argument. You know, it's not economically viable. It has adjacent developed properties. There are problems there. The groundwater issue itself is enough reason not to farm it any further, because the recharge, the water table is 6 feet from the surface, so the recharge is almost immediate, and then this groundwater plume goes right to an area where the Springfield Utility Board has wells, and that's part of the municipal water supply. So they've studied all this stuff. They know how long it takes for everything to get to their fields, and pretty interesting how they do that, but a lot of impact on groundwater. There's a public park on the south of this, so there are also implications to the public, people wanting to do nature study close to the Willamette River and farming and spraying. And so the chemical aspect of it has been big, but we've looked at the impact then of what 10 septic tanks and drain fields would pose on the property. Also, the comparison of the nitrates, the slough to the north is a wetland, but they have a state permit to excavate an area that's 40 feet by 150 feet by 8 feet deep. That fills with water, and then they irrigate up to 800 gallons a minute out of that. So there are a lot of things associated with some of these old agricultural properties. But that's just kind of particular to this one, I think. And again, I'm not trying to sell that project to you. I'm just trying to give you a base for process. And I think, again, that the issue with regards to this bill, and I like the fact that it changes this language, where right now it says any other land use planning goal you basically don't have to conform to. It changes it to say just goal regulating urbanization, because you should have to comply with any of the other goals that relate to environmental resources, certainly. But urbanization, as defined in the state goals, it relates to the urban growth boundaries, and it relates specifically to the provision of municipal water and wastewater utilities. And rural development relies wholly on self-contained systems. There's a state bill that was passed 4 or 5 years ago that Lane County is just now starting to look at. But it actually enables the rural communities, which are all exception areas, to zone to any density they desire. And part of the intent is to try to bring some employment back into the rural communities and things like that. Lane County has been real slow to sort of adopt that, and that may still take a long time. But that gets into the issues of then if a rural community wants to develop to a higher density and they have to develop a water and wastewater system, then that's urban development. And that happens on to goal 14.
Other questions? Good morning.
Hey, was there any agricultural activity taking place in the vicinity of Chase Estates?
No, they were the only people who farmed. There's an 18-acre parcel that's just to the left of your sheet here. It's been vacant since 1965. The parcel to the right here is being lived on, has a big shop on. About 42% of it is class 4 to class 7 soils. There's a lot of rock in this particular area. It's an area where the middle fork of the Willamette River meandered a lot. So there are a lot of old meander channels. So it's not terribly productive. However, my argument on the subject property would not be that it's not good soil. There's just other things happening there. And it's not large enough to do, have a large enough agricultural endeavor to be economical.
May I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair? Have you done other kinds of projects of this nature in Lane County? Would you find as a general rule that the reasons that you're encountering that limit the agricultural capabilities of a piece of land are real site specific, or would you find that there are general rules that would work?
Well, agriculture is kind of a tough one because it depends on what you're trying to grow. You know, you can grow things in greenhouses now and not have any soil and make more money than certainly these people ever made. I have clients who have 400 or 500 acres of agricultural land in the Junction City area, which you would think is good soil. They have problems. Agriculture is just getting tougher and tougher. It's getting more difficult, I think, for people to make money because their costs go up and the complaints continue to come in. There was a lawsuit out in that area in Junction City where the farmer lost a lawsuit. It was a trespass lawsuit. He had dust that was going on other people's property. He lost the lawsuit and had to pay money. These smaller parcels like this are fairly isolated, I think, if that's really what you were kind of looking at. Most of the, like Lane County, most of the agricultural land, still the parcels for the most part are still fairly large, I think.
Okay. Other questions? Thanks, Tom.
Okay.
Let's see. Bob Liberty?
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. I'm Robert Liberty, Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon, and I want to tell you a little bit about my interest and credentials in this issue area. Actually, I think the case that you've heard about, which is the case I argued in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, I believe began in this room in 1982 and sitting in the chairs you're sitting in with the members of the Land Conservation Development Commission. So now we're coming to full circle on this very important matter. Actually, that's about 1984. I also have had the experience of reviewing proposed exceptions to Goals 3 and 4. I'm going to explain what those are from my perspective. And I don't mean on paper. I mean on the ground, going to look at them in these counties, Coos, Curry, Jefferson, Lynn, Lane, Morrill, Umatilla, some in Jackson, and some in other counties. I was attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon in the case 1000 Friends of Oregon v. LCDC in Curry County. What I'm going to cover is some basic information about exception areas, what they are, where they are, the current state of the law governing development in exception areas, and the consequences should Senate Bill 1187 become law. First, let me clarify something about what these kinds of exceptions are. They're called developed and committed. Now, imagine a checkerboard, and on the black square, those are each 5 acres, and on the black square, there's a house. And on the red square, there is no house. And that's an old subdivision, maybe platted in the 1920s or 1910s. And this is done all over America and all over Oregon as well. What the agency said and was upheld in much earlier litigation was, look, the soil's great, we'll suppose, but no one's going to bring their combine in on to the red squares in between the houses. No one's going to do aerial spraying. And so even though half of that land is not developed, is vacant, it's the phrase, unfortunate, is committed to development. What it means is you can't farm it anymore because it's surrounding development. So there were two kinds of exceptions, actually, not one. Developed, which meant there was a structure on it, although it might be one house on 10 acres. And then committed, which means there was no development on it, but it was so affected by surrounding development it was regarded as being outside the farm or forest land base. Now, this process of identifying these areas took 12 years. And involved going out, collecting records, in our case, going out and looking at the land. Sometimes I toured with farmers or woodlot owners to get their evaluation of them, taking photographs. And this was sifted down until we ended up with, I think, probably quite a bit more than was justified, 750,000 acres. Now, I want to give you, first of all, and I don't want to distract you from this terribly absorbing testimony, but I'm going to give you the statistics by county. That was our first exhibit.
This is from a table prepared about 10 or 12 years ago. The numbers are fairly accurate, and I have some more information about them in a moment. When you get a copy, you'll see a set of columns. All of this is rural zoning. None of this has anything to do with urban lands. And you'll see a column that says residential, commercial, or three columns, residential, commercial, and industrial. Those add up to actually about 765,000 acres, several hundred, well, actually 1,200 square miles, an area about the size of this county, Marion County. Most of it, you'll see, is zoned residential, 710,000 acres, about 10,000 is zoned commercial, and about 46,000 is zoned industrial. Now, 46,000 acres is bigger than many of our mid-sized cities or growth centers. So you can see it's distributed all over the state. Proportionately by population, there's more of it outside the Willamette Valley than in, although there are substantial amounts in counties here, particularly Clackamas County, about 77,000 acres, and Lane County, 60,000 acres plus. So that's the amount and the zoning. Now I want to... Actually, I'll describe to you a little bit what the development is like on these lands. Some of these lands look like cities, but that is a very small proportion of total. A lot of this are small home sites. What you see in the Willamette Valley, you see a little cluster of houses or homes that are 2 and 5 or 10 acres. Those are exception areas. A lot of them, of course, don't have any houses on them at all. In fact, I recently got information from Deschutes County that indicates that under existing zoning, they have now, or could have, 10,000, and I'm going to repeat that number, 10,000 lots that could have houses on them in their exception areas. So think about that. Deschutes County has a population of 100,000, and we're talking about lots available for 10,000 new houses outside urban growth boundaries. In fact, in research commissioned by the 1989 legislature, found that in a four-year period, half of all the new development in Deschutes County occurred in rural areas. So there's a substantial amount of potential for development and a substantial amount of development going on in the exception areas. Now I want to show you actually how they're located around the state. Let's start with this first map.
This is a map we prepared using 1986 zoning data. I'm going to put it right here. Sorry, we'll turn it around for the audience here in a moment. What you see is the land that is in color is private land. Everything in this orange color is inside urban growth boundaries. Portland, Salem, Corvallis, Albany, Eugene, and Springfield. The this shade of turquoise are forest lands and forest zoning. The shade of green and the shade of green are exclusive farming zones. All of the red are the exception areas. So this is several hundred thousand acres, although less than half of the state total, in red that is zoned for rural residential, rural commercial, rural industrial. I'm going to give you a close-up of a predecessor map of this area and of Eugene Springfield. One thing that you'll notice is if you follow down the freeways that there are exception areas that freeway interchange is actually quite a bit up here, so what you see at Aurora Mountain is actually in an exception area. Although the infamous Woodburn development is actually inside an urban growth boundary approved 20 years ago. Let's take a look at the other map. By the way, the shading in here which actually shows existing rural density, which is quite a bit higher than a lot of people realize. This is a map prepared by Douglas County. At the request of then LCDC Commissioner John Brigati. It uses a different color scheme. So in this case, this is red is inside urban growth boundaries, and it shows southwestern Oregon from the coast to the crest of the Cascade Range, at least county boundaries, and from Lane County to the California border. Red are inside urban growth boundaries. The blue are the exception areas. So you'll see, for example, in this area, Grants Pass has, it looks like, the bulk of their 67,000 acres of rural residential is contiguous to either other exception areas or the Grants Pass urban growth boundary. Substantial amount on the floor of the Bear Creek and Rogue Valley, and then going up all of the river valleys in rural Lane County. And then, of course, in Curry County, where the case began, running this chain runs for 10 miles along Highway 101. Now, what I'm going to do, thanks, Gary, is I'm going to distribute maps that have close-ups of some of those areas, along with some other information. If you've seen the maps, you can look at the detail in a bit. I think you'll find them revealing.
Now, what is the current state of the law on this issue? Actually, the Curry County case covered a lot more than this issue. It covered a whole bunch of issues that aren't the subject of this proposed legislation. However, it did, the issues that we're talking about did address Goal 11 and Goal 14, not just Goal 14. Now, the issue was, okay, these lands aren't available for farm or forest use because of development on the property or nearby. What development can occur? Now imagine we have a statewide planning program, the keystone of which has been to identify where we're going to have urban development and the rest will be rural. So the issue, the argument that I presented to half of 1,000 friends was, if it's outside an urban growth boundary, it should stay rural. urban growth boundaries don't mean anything if all the red areas are blue in the Southwest Oregon map can be the site for 5,000 square foot lots, condominiums, shopping malls, theaters, strip commercial development, factories. Then Goal 14 wouldn't mean anything. Yet that, so the holding in the case, the Supreme Court's holding, is very, very simple. If it's outside an urban growth boundary, it should stay rural. I think, now, well, this really tests my memory, the case citation is 301 Oregon 447, and you'll find that holding around page 510. I'd be glad to show it to you. I certainly remember the case. So what happens if 1187 passes is it's not just about rural residential development. It means that there is no state limitation on the types or intensities of development. Now, one of the issues that has been raised is, well, would this actually happen? Would this land be rezoned? Wouldn't counties exercise prudence? Let's think about some things that have already happened. Do you think if you owned a 10-acre parcel in Lincoln County that under the existing law was zoned for 10-acre lots, or even a 5-acre parcel zoned for 5-acre minimum lot size with one house on it, and someone came to you and said, if we get your property rezoned, we can put 150 condominiums on it, and you'll be a millionaire. How many people will say no to that proposal on the Oregon coast? Let's give another example. There are exception areas around many freeway interchanges. In fact, one of the early cases led up to the Supreme Court case was brought by the city of Ashland that did not want to have commercial scale development on interchange of Siskiyou Boulevard, I believe it was, and Interstate 5. Do you think that a property owner who has something that has to be kept rural under state law now will say no to a real estate agent who says, this site is big enough for a regional mall, and it's at the intersection of a state highway and an interstate freeway? You'll be a millionaire tomorrow if this rezoning occurs. Do you think people will say no to that? And do you think no one will propose that? Yes, they will. That's why, in fact, the Factory Outlet Center is located at an interchange on I-5, although in that case it's inside room growth boundary. Let's take a third example, the Mackenzie River Valley. Very desirable place, very close commuting for Eugene Springfield. Zoned, I think, 2, 5, 10 acre minimum lot sizes now. Do you think people would say no? The realtor said, let's rezone these for half-acre lots along the Mackenzie or tributaries of the Mackenzie. My understanding is that actually staff members of Lane County are already considering allowing a lot higher density of development in the Mackenzie River Valley. I could go on in Central Oregon now. Jefferson County has just rezoned 10,000 acres from farm use to, out of farm use zones, and they're debating what would be authorized in those. That is a 30-minute commute, roughly, to St. Charles Hospital in Bend. Now, do you think if there's no state limitation that they would choose 10 or 20-acre parcels? And remember, this is ranch land now. We're not talking about clearing that's already broken up the way some of these other properties are. Do you think they would prefer 1 acre or 2 acre? I think this would have very significant consequences. Almost immediately, there would be significant rezoning to allow condominiums on the coast, shopping malls at the freeway interchanges, 5,000, 10,000 square foot lots in many places of Oregon. What would be the effect? Well, now the bill says, the proponents say it only applies to Goal 14. Actually, the bill says urbanization goals. I think that includes Goal 11 because that's how the Supreme Court interpreted it as one of the goals. Why? Because we brought up that issue and said you can't have urban levels of services in rural areas. But it's not clear whether it applies to Goal 14 or Goal 11. But if you allow these kinds of developments, they will require services. Children will need to get to school. They'll need school buses. There will be a lot more traffic on the road. The roads will have to be improved. Maintenance costs will go up. When you get to half-acre lots, quarter-acre lots, there are a lot of soils in Oregon where that will be an issue about disposal of waste. There may be a need to extend sewer services, water. What about groundwater withdrawals in places like Umatilla County, or for that matter, the Chehalem Hills on the Yamhill, Washington County line? Some of those are already groundwater depletion areas or have been in the past. When you start tripling or quadrupling the number of wells, what will happen to their groundwater supplies? The impacts on forestry are pretty important because there is a relationship between rural density and forest fire frequency. the Department of Forestry has plotted this. People cause fires. They don't mean to, but they do. You add more people in a forest zone, there'll be more fires. You'll pay for the fire service. The property owners will pay for loss of their timber. Impacts on farming have been touched on. I think we'll hear more testimony on that point. I think this will be, when you look at how the exception areas are scattered all through in the Willamette Valley, the Bear Creek Valley, right next to commercial farming areas, this is another problem that farmers will have to deal with. And finally, I guess I read the...
You'll get your chance, please. We have to maintain decorum. Thank you.
I think the other issue, of course, is that if you look at the area around Newburgh, for example, when they have to expand their urban growth boundary, they're already surrounded by exception areas. Are they going to choose to take two-acre lots with houses on them or quarter-acre lots if this bill passes with houses on them? Will they say, oh, we don't want to urbanize that and service that. We're going to take the farmland. That actually was already proposed in Newburgh. So part of what has been required as a result of these exception areas being close to urban growth boundaries is that LCDC adopted an urban reserve rule so that they would not develop in such a way that they couldn't be converted to urban uses later. I think 1187, by knocking out Goal 14 from rural area, makes that urban reserve rule a nullity. There's no way you can say it applies and it doesn't apply. It would be invalidated. So what are my conclusions? Well, first, if this is a local control bill, it's kind of interesting that neither the counties nor the cities are supporting it. The counties did not ask for this bill. That, I think, ought to make you wonder if they are clamoring to have control over this and to allow to open it up to everyone who wants to increase intensity of development in these rural areas. The second point I'd make is, do you really think that the people who live there are going to be happy when they find out that their neighbor has gotten approval for condominium development? Will they be happy when they find out that the rural landscape they thought they were living in is actually now available for quarter-acre lots? I think there'll be a lot of rural discontent. Finally, what this bill does is repeals a key part of Oregon's planning program, which was to contain urban sprawl, to put urbanization where it belonged inside urban growth boundaries. If this passes, you've removed a key prop by allowing urbanization on an additional 750,000 acres with all the consequences I've described. I'll be glad to answer questions. Oh, I'm sorry, I have one other bit of information, which is this is information on the zoning of the rural residential exception areas is actually very hard information to come by, and there's some counties where the information is kind of blended, for example, Lane County, but it still shows that about 450,000 acres, at least, of the 750,000 is in 4, 5, or 10-acre minimum lot sizes, and those are the lot sizes that could be changed down to a quarter acre or 5,000 square foot lots or condominiums or shopping malls or whatever should 1187 become law.
Questions? Well, Bob, some of your testimony float above and some of them have holes in it. I think that when we start supporting government regulation that will limit opportunity for wealth in America, we run smack dab into socialism. One of these days, you and a thousand friends are going to figure that out, and when you come before this committee, you will restrain yourself from irritating some of us on that issue, because there are issues of protecting those who are trying to do resource development in areas, and they don't want to be buzzed by a certain amount of development. You know, that there's an argument for that. But when in your testimony we are, through regulation, going to limit being able to have a decision to sell our land and make a profit on it for development, that's government control and regulation for an American dream for building wealth. Irritates me. I had to get that out of my system.
We do therapy, too. We don't charge by the hour.
All right.
Neckert.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Would it be possible to get Mr. Lindy back up at the
table? Yes, we can.
Just a couple of minutes.
Bob, come on up.
I think I'm kind of starting to get the picture here. So we've got essentially what are committed lands is what we're on the table discussing. If there was an application within a county to rezone to a smaller lot size, something that was already in one of these areas, they would need to go through a zone change process and then a partitioning or a subdivision process. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's basically correct. If somebody or if the county itself wanted to change the zoning on land that's in an exception area, then that's a zone change process. That typically the county doesn't go through a partitioning process at that point. It would just authorize people at some point in the future to partition to create smaller lots than currently would be allowed.
Okay, so a property owner would need to come in and make an application for a zone change, which may or may not involve a comp plan amendment. And then at the point where they, if they're successful in getting the zone change, then they would need to go in and make application to either partition or subdivide before they could actually do anything. Does this piece of legislation affect that process in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, usually not, but here's when it affects it. If most people are able to partition in an exception area, I don't have any numbers, but without a zone change. It's the question of when a landowner says, well, I've got 2 acres, I want 2 1-acre properties, but the zone today says limit is 2 acres. Then that property owner would have to approach the county and ask for a zone change to allow 1 acre. But they wouldn't necessarily have to take an exception at that point. It depends on whether creating 2 1-acre lots creates urban development. Creating 2 1-acre lots usually wouldn't create urban development, but Goal 14 would apply in that the county would have to say exactly what I just did, that is, that we hereby allow this zone change to allow more dense development in this exception area. However, we don't think that it's urban, so we don't apply Goal 14. And that's usually what happens. The only time what this bill affects the property owner, as Mr. Liberty just discussed, who wants to change the zone that might be 10, 5, or 2, or 1 right now to allow something where you would create urban lots, condos or lots or a shopping center or something else. That zone change would run up against our urbanization goals. And at that point, the county would, depending on, again, how intense it is, would say, this is urban use. If we're going to allow this, we have to take an exception to those urbanization goals. But it's only in those instances that you run up against that, and most of the partitioning that takes place in the exception areas doesn't create urban development. As I mentioned earlier, we haven't defined that line. Counties, I think many counties have been happy with that because when you create a third of an acre, a half an acre, when is it that you cross the line? And right now it's vague and counties make that call. However, we have proposed a rule that we call a safe harbor. Counties, and we're trying to come up with a lot size where we say, in most instances it's sort of a case-by-case decision, but if we want to create something where we would declare, LCDC is contemplating declaring that any time you create a 5-acre lot or higher, you're always rural. Now, that isn't a hidden agenda that we think everything in rural areas ought to be 5 acres. And that rule wasn't adopted because we still are far from getting agreement as to what that safe harbor ought to be. But we do want to create a rule that would apply in all circumstances so that as counties allow upzoning, they know unequivocally that they aren't creating rural urban development.
Okay, can I ask one more question?
Follow up.
Let's assume for a minute that this becomes law. And let's assume that a property owner comes in under the scenario that you just described and wants to put condos on a 10-acre parcel. Would they still be required to go through a zoning process that requires them to address where they're getting the water, what they're doing with the sewage, how the access is addressed, the effect that they're having on the surrounding property owners, that part of the process wouldn't change?
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Morgan, I can't see how it would change. The only difference, if this bill passes, they'll be able to create or authorize the extension of new sewer and water systems and roads and all those things you just described, and there would be, the county would be able to authorize those extensions, and the county would be able to authorize those condominiums without going through what we call the exceptions process. That's the difference. Today, the county would have to take an exception to authorize those services and to authorize those condos. That would be a difficult process. It isn't easy to get that Goal 14 exception. And so the result is, up and down the coast, even though there are many, many acres of exception lands, those aren't going to be developed in condominiums because people aren't going to be able to get through the exceptions process unless this bill passes.
Well, and I know that in the area that I'm familiar with in Southern Oregon, that it the wholesale development that you fear is going to be a real problem because there simply isn't services available. There isn't public water and sewer available to a lot of the exception areas. They're the places where the roads cross. And historically, a few houses have grown up there. There is no municipal water or sewer available to them.
Mr. Chair, Herr Morgan, a few years ago, we got into this same issue with the interchange near the city of Donald, which is an exception area. The city ultimately went through that process and extended that sewer for 2 miles, city sewer, 2 miles to serve what is, as you see as you drive through there, increasingly going to be urban development. You're correct. In many places, those services will be difficult to come by, but if this bill passes, there are certainly going to be many creative schemes to get sewer and water systems to these areas that today are prevented by our urbanization goals.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Liz Frankel.
Thank you, Liz Frankel, for the League of Women Voters. I just want to say that the League does oppose this bill. We've been involved in land use planning since it began. We are a statewide organization, and we care deeply about, and obviously so do many, many other people. It is clearly a highly emotional subject here today, but we do care very deeply about the statewide planning goals. Initially, when we got involved in land use planning, it was stated that we needed to get out of balkanization, of each county going its own way. There's obviously some disagreement, but we like the statewide planning goals. That's what they are. And they are then implemented at the local level. This we appreciate. I won't bother you with any of the other statements, since obviously many of them have already been made, but I appreciate this opportunity to state the League's position. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Other questions? All right. Ray Phelps and Dan Cooper.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Ray Phelps. I'm here representing Metro. With me is Dan Cooper, who's Metro's General Counsel. He has some comments he'd like to share with the committee. He has spoken, I think, to most of the committee members earlier this week. So I just let Dan take over.
Okay. Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Neil Cooper. I'm Metro's General Counsel. My address is 600 Northeast Grand in Portland, 97232. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Metro Council and the Executive Officer in opposition to Senate Bill 1187. This is the only land use bill that Metro is opposing this session. We oppose this bill because we believe it would effectively repeal the statewide planning goal that regulates where, when, and how land becomes urbanized. The 1995 session of the legislature adopted House Bill 2709, and the 1997 the legislature adopted House Bill 2493. these laws required Metro and the large cities in the state to ensure that there was going to be a 20-year land supply for housing within inside their urban growth boundaries. We did not oppose those bills. We worked with their proponents and made sure that they would work for us. You are currently have in front of you Senate Bill 87 that would adopt similar rules for retail, commercial, and industrial land. We are neutral on that bill, and we have worked with the proponents to make sure that the bill lines up with what our actual practices are right now. Carrying out House Bill 2709 and 2493, we have moved the urban growth boundary a considerable amount last year, and we are working on moving the urban growth boundary even more this year to meet the need as we determine it. All the work we have done, the laws you have passed, are premised on the continued existence and validity of Goal 14. If you adopt Senate Bill 1187, this work at best is put into a state of total confusion and probably is rendered meaningless, because the urban growth boundary would no longer effectively draw a line between urban areas and rural areas in exceptional areas. We have spent millions of dollars and held exhaustive public hearings in this process. Those public hearings have been heavily attended. We are right now, as I have said, completing the process. We ask that you not change the rules now and let you finish the job you have assigned to us. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jeff Watkins.
Chair Welsh, members of the committee, Jeff Watkins with the Sierra Club Oregon chapter, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 1187. And I really think there's been a lot of testimony, some better than others today, but there's really not anything that I can add or oppose to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. John Chalmers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, here in opposition to Senate Bill 1187. Start by respectively disagreeing with Mr. Schmidt. We believe that this bill does turn the planning program upside down. These exception areas have been reviewed for their compatibility with surrounding resource land. And you heard Mr. Johnson's description of how that happened. I can't improve on that, but it's been determined that these exception areas are currently compatible with the surrounding farmland if the exception area is in a farm zone. This bill allows counties to ignore those limits and develop at urban level development. Land use planning was adopted to stop leapfrog development. And this bill, if it passes, will just reinstate the potential for leapfrog development. So in that regard, it is our opinion that it does turn land use planning upside down, takes us right back to where we were before land use planning. He also talks about there being no in-between. It is either high density or rural. I would disagree with that. The exception areas are 1 acre, 2 acres, 3 acre, 4 acre, the smaller acres. They aren't rural. They aren't urban. They are the in-between. And that's what they're for, and that's what we believe they need to stay. I'd also say the Farm Bureau has no hidden agenda in opposing this bill. I'll state clearly, our intent is to protect agriculture producers from conflict caused by increased traffic, free-roaming dogs, vandalism, to protect from diminishing water supply, increased water pollution from septic systems, and complaints about farming practices. And I would remind you, these are not hollow fears that we have. Even currently, there's a resident in Wasco County, a resident in a farm zone, a non-farm dwelling in a farm zone, who is currently actively trying to shut down aerial spraying in Wasco County. I would maybe just close with a comment about Mr. Miller's comments. It's my opinion, after listening to his comments, that he very well made the case why we don't want to do this. He talked about many of the conflicts and many of the problems that agriculture has. Senate Bill 1187 certainly wouldn't improve agriculture's position and their ability to produce in an EFU zone. So I'll just close then by saying the Farm Bureau is strongly opposed to Senate Bill 1187 and would ask for your opposition to it. Thank you.
That's true. Yeah, thank you. John, earlier in your testimony when you made reference to free roaming dogs, does that mean you support the seatbelt for dogs bill? Or?
It doesn't have to in rural areas. You're discriminated in many ways.
Do I have to comment, Mr. Chairman?
Not all done.
You know, Mr. Schoenberg, we hear these comments that farmers aren't getting enough money, farming isn't paying off, and so that's the reason we should just go ahead and develop farmland. I'm still concerned for the safety of our food chain. I like knowing where our food comes from, and so I don't think we're always going, I mean, I don't know what the market's going to do. We never know that. It may be that our farmland will become our most valuable economically also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, we certainly agree with that. And that is the reason the Farm Bureau, our position is that we are here to protect the agricultural industry, not the individual farmer. We're looking at what is best for agriculture because you're absolutely right. The food chain is what we need to be concerned about. In America, we've never been hungry. We've not had that problem. But the way things are going, it leads one to fear that there may come a time when we do have that kind of situation. So, again, that's why we are here opposing this bill.
One more accusation, Mr. Chair, you know. I know that farming's always been a little dusty, smelly, and noisy, but I think there also I think there also are some aesthetic values to those of us who are not farmers. I like driving through Washington County right now, looking at the red clover.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, and Representative Cruz. I would suggest that Representative Taylor was not referring to you individually.
No.
Although we don't. No, he resembles that. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schoenberg, just adding up these numbers just briefly, it looks like out of those 750,000 acres of exception lands in Oregon, about a quarter of a million acres, roughly 250,000 acres, are in the Willamette Valley, or an area slightly larger than the urban growth boundary for the Portland metropolitan area. What would you say the future of agriculture would be in the Willamette Valley if those other 250,000 acres of land developed as extensively as they could under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, the future would be dimmer. It would be bleak. You can't say that agriculture would simply disappear because of that, but there's certainly going to be increased impact, negative impact. And the other issue that we always have to be concerned about is the agricultural infrastructure that we have and that we have to maintain. And if you take, while you're developing land, currently some of it is being farmed. I mean, some of it are small parcels, and there's some farming going on those, hobby farming, granted, but nevertheless farming. But you would take some of that out of production as well. But our biggest concern is the potential for conflict. And I talked about the traffic increase being one, and I think Washington County has a very big problem with that issue right now. And if you were to develop every one of those exception areas to their maximum extent, you'd have gridlock. A lot worse than you have it right now.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Alan. Okay, Art Schlack. Could stand it, could you?
Nope. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And let me say first, our association has not taken a position on 1187. But I felt it's necessary to clarify at least a couple of our concerns, because we do have some concerns with the Curry County case, and those have been running around for 15-odd years, and they're still present. The counties deal with Curry County in a couple of ways. One, we have worked and we have a rule on rural communities, which has helped. However, there is still some concern in it by a number of counties and the limitations that it's placed on commercial and industrial development in rural communities. And that continues to create a problem which we would like to see revisited to some extent. The second one, which is an ongoing issue, is the fact that we have the rural residential questions with respect to Curry County is yet to be resolved. And so even though we have exception areas zoned primarily into, I'll call it, large rural lot development pattern, 5-10 acres, there still is some, in isolated cases, some 1-acre zoning that exists in exception areas, and maybe in some 2-acre in various places. And the question has always been, is this urban or is this rural? And if it is, because of Curry County, we have to go through a rather laborious process to justify either an exception to Goal 14 or try and make a case that, you know, 1 acre in this situation with these kinds of services is not urban and it's not going to create a problem. That continues to be something that taxes the resources of many of the counties. And we have held off addressing. I mean, it's been 15 years trying to resolve this problem. We still haven't got it yet. And we had some discussions with LCDC recently, and those now are in abeyance because of this very issue. So I just want to, even though the concerns that are being expressed, I think, go beyond what most counties would like to see resolved, there are the questions that I've indicated with respect to what is an appropriate rural residential density that is not urban that we'd like to get resolved so we can put that behind us. And eliminate some of the periodic review requirements that we had, and also be able to deal with the question of commercial and industrial development in rural communities with the idea that 10,000 square feet in a structure may be a little bit too limiting in some instances. You understand you can go through the exceptions process, but the exception process is not always the most friendly process to go through. And I just wanted to make those comments for the record, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the
opportunity. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. And Don, let's see. Philip, Phil. Is he? Yes, he is here today. Okay. Well, maybe you get the award today.
I think, yeah, that's the award order there.
Louise Woodlick.
Chairman Welch and members of the committee, I am Mrs. Louise Weidlich, Director of the Neighborhoods Protective Association, and my post office box is 19224 Portland, Oregon, 97219. I'm also a president of a small group we call ourselves Mothers for Children, and I would like to approach this as a homeowner and a family and mother who is concerned in the city of Portland of densifying our whole area. We have been having meetings for 2 years and meetings and planning commission. And my first page here is October 14, 1997 letter. I really did not write a letter to you, but I am just giving you some of the information that has come up in the Portland area. The people that seem to be addressing it today seem to be not wanting us to move out into the country. And they wanted to put row housing right next door to us. And we live near the Multnomah area. And it's just going to crowd everything. And then the second area issue is the fact that they are going to mix affordable housing in with it. And with the affordable housing, you're going to get people who do not have the same respect for private property and the honesty. They found in other areas of the country, I don't have the specifics, but in other areas of the country where they have had more crime and more, people just don't have the same respect for things. We can leave our hoses out now and different things in the yard and not worry about it. But if they change this, they want to put 700,000 people in the Portland area if we don't expand the urban growth boundary and allow for some more acreage. Now, that's a lot of people. So anyway, this letter that I wrote to the Planning Commission in 1997, the hearings on the design of regulations, are they real or just window dressing after passage of a 13-page document regarding community planning follow-up proposals? Their interim design regulations for infill development defy our freedom as set down in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. The idea of the government reversing our present freedom of choice with all these regulations is preposterous. I'm talking about design regulations. Row housing is ugly and offensive to most of those I have talked to here in Portland. The very idea of wanting to densify our whole area in one breath, and in the next breath, on page one of the introduction, you say, the problem faces us is how to accommodate this growth and still preserve the quality of life in Portland. I say, unless we expand, there is no quality of life in Portland in the future. It can get less and less. To continue, there are many tools that can help us achieve this goal. One of the most significant is design. I'm quoting from an article in the Planning Commission. Then you say, when new housing is added into our city, it is important that it is designed to fit with the surrounding area. Portland's characteristic. New housing should not detract from the character of our existing neighborhood. For housing to fit in with our rural area, that's ridiculous. Absolutely makes me mad, and people are angry. Zoning the way you are planning, it violates our Constitution and Bill of Rights, and the American Creed is as follows, allows a tax sheet. Also encloses a copy of the Bill of Rights. Didn't give that to you today. The very idea of the bureaucracy deciding what, how, where we can build, and then they decide the designing of what we can live in, row housing and the regimentation of our city is very sad and frightening. At the bottom of the page, you see examples of the row housing. One of the early meetings we had was on October 17, 1996. Shows Southwest neighborhood residents furious over zoning plan. We had about at least 500 people came to that meeting. And the city planners' need to increase density strikes a strong chord of resistance in the Multnomah neighborhood. So that's my first page. And I inserted the National Day of Prayer and my Mother's Day are gifts to our children, mainly because I'm looking at it as a parent and as a family. Our country is founded, is self-sustaining, and our sovereignty is essential to the family unit. And I have heard nothing here said about caring about the family or about the children having a place to play or anything. They're probably going to not want any of us to have children, but just live in these row houses and cut down the size of our lots so that we have to go to a park for them to even, when they can't play. And in the winter, we have 9 months of rain in Oregon. I don't know why they're so worried about it. So that's all I'm going to say on that. And this shows, the second page here, shows you the interim design regulations that are put out by our City Planning Commission. And it tells about how strict they're going to be. Porches are required for row houses to improve the fit of the row houses with other nearby development. Row house porches create a transitional space at the entrance of the house. The porch also creates an opportunity for outdoor living activities that will create opportunity for the household to interact with neighbors. Why do we want to interact with neighbors? Most people don't want it. If they want to see their neighbor, they can go see him, but they don't have to interact with them.
Another suggestion is to reduce the front seat setback for row houses. They had quite a fight in Portland just recently in which they said Michael Roach, who didn't come here today, I don't even know about the meeting, but he's been our land use planner in the Multnomah area, and they at least came up with that houses, row houses had to be set back to the same distance as the other houses on the street. But that, I don't know whether that even passed or not. But I know some of the things are real close. So that's that one. And then on the back, I have here some articles of Bill of Rights here that we handed out with our meeting. Higher taxes will result. It will arrange so that if you have a house, and it's an older house, and it's 100, you have a 100-foot lot, they can put 6 row houses on that property. So if a person is older, the value of the land of the house will go way up. They can buy it and tear down the house and put in 6 row houses. So what have they got to lose? I mean, you know, people are going to have to move out. But how can they move out if they want a family, if there is no land available? I like to relate some of this to our country's history. I'd like to refer back to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and I won't go into detail on it. But we've got to get back to some reasonable thinking. That 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are in a grave and a great civil war testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can longer endure. I would say we're in the battlefield right now. So I won't go into detail on it, but anyway.
Louise, can I open up questions, please?
What?
Can I open it to questions?
I'd like to say one other thing here. I added another sheet on here that I see today where they want to breach 2 dams already. And I have here an article that I put at the back of the seat if you're in the Water Resources Committee, and I'd like to say that here it says that nylon filament, non-filament nets form walls 20 to 35 miles long and 30 feet deep. They can trap porpoises, salmon, and seabirds, as well as squid. If nets are lost, they do not degrade, but continue to drift. Altering dams to try to boost salmon runs could cost millions, billions, and take a decade. Do not remove dams. Y2K threatens water shortage. If we have a water shortage, we need the dams to preserve the water for when we need it. And it also, dams protect our water supply. Foreign takeover of water and energy, we must stop mergers. I spoke to the Public Utilities Commissioner opposing Enron's takeover and now the Scottish Power takeover. These are international places. They don't care about Oregon or the Northwest. They want to lower our energy sources and lower our water so that we're just like peons like every other nation. So, anyway, I won't do that. But this is examples of what they try to give to us in the city. This is a map showing the... They don't notify... You don't have to notify the homeowners either that this is happening. It's only as people get involved and, you know, and from word of mouth and so forth. But they show this, and then they make another change in here, and where they, and then they sort in these little things. Now, how many people are going to go through and look through that map and know about it? I know that Associated Oregon, Oregon Onions in Action, was trying to get through a bill that required homeowners to be notified when this happened, but it didn't pass. So I thought that. Maps, you know, they come to the map, but then they make another map, and, you know, and people are so busy with their own lives and trying to live. How can they follow through on all this? So, save our neighborhoods. Stop row house cloning. Stop crowding. Stop density. Stop unaffordable subsidized housing. Stop strict design regulations. Oppose tax subsidy, local improvement districts. who will pay for new sewers and roads? Keep our existing neighborhoods, family-friendly neighborhoods, are safe from crime. Metro's plan to put 700,000 people in the Portland area, making it as dense as New York City. The inevitable consequences of density are higher taxes, crime, overcrowded, subsidized housing, which is not affordable. This rezoning plan will increase density with mandated multifamily dwellings and row housing up to three stories high. Express your opposition. They worry about, you know, we used to be able to go and get 5 acres. You had a farm, you could have a horse, and, you know, your children have a place to have a horse to ride and a place to play, or they could have a garden or something like that. And there's all that land out there. Why can't we use some of it? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, ladies. I got another bill I got to hear. So
okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Cliff Knage.
He said, get a whole bunch of people. I just knew this was not listed on the today to have the hearing. I just have to keep in touch with this one because this is very important and is important to our whole life and our way of life in the United States. Thank you.
We agree with you. Thank you.
I am Cliff Kennedy, a farmer from Albany. I'm impressed with your patience, and I will try not to test it too much. My family is a consider ourselves to be a family farm. We're in partnership with a son, and we hire a 1.5 full-time person. This bill would bring more conflicts near the exception areas. Conflicts are problems when they're close, and they're problems when there are more people. The beauty of our land use laws allows for anyone to do anything. Our land use laws merely require that you do it in designated areas in order to minimize conflicts. I'd just like to tell you a few stories of the conflicts I've experienced. In 63, 10 houses went in along one fence line, and it seemed like I could never irrigate without getting a complaint from one of the neighbors that I was getting water across the fence. I don't know who they complained to when it rained. But anyway, I alleviate that problem. I spent $600 getting a special set of sprinklers that I could set right by the fence and irrigate only one direction. At another spot, there were three duplexes right across the road, and I had planted a crop, contracted to a processor, and one day I saw that they were out there with their airplanes doing aerial spraying, and they were doing a beautiful job. They were going right along the close to the field toward the duplexes, and they shut off the spray and went up over the duplexes. Now, that scared me. I haven't raised that crop in that field since, and I won't. Another time, I had a haystack piled near the road. I noticed three kids on top of that haystack, bales of hay, throwing the bales down. They were having the ball. And I rushed down there, but by the time I got there to kick them out, the haystack had fallen over on top of them, and one kid was buried to his shoulders in bales of hay, and the other two kids were trying desperately to uncover him. I don't think they would have accomplished it unless I would have been there. But I was so scared, I didn't even get mad. And these kids, they didn't live real close. I think they came from about 0.4 mile distance. And another time where I have houses on two fence lines, I had strawberries there. And in the morning, I had phoned the custom applicator to come and spray my berries. Mid-morning, I went out there to see how he was doing. When I got out there to the field, he was spraying, racing down the strawberry rows. And also in the strawberry field was a grandfather, a mother, and a child trying to catch their horse. Those berries were knee-high. They were wet with chemical. And that scared me. Chemical operator and myself talked to these people. We sent them home, asked them to take showers and to launder their clothes. Another time, we happened to have an unusual crop of strawberries in the fall. And I noticed that in the evening, some of the kids were sneaking in from the back fence and they were eating the strawberries. But this was at a time when I needed to apply some flood bait. It's recommended that you apply flood bait in the fall. That's the best, most efficient time to get them. But I didn't feel it was safe to apply flood bait when those kids were going, getting in there, and I didn't have a good way of controlling them, so I just did not flood bait in the berries that time. Another time, my horse complained to me that the tree, they were sitting under the tree to eat their lunch, and the neighbor across the fence was cleaning up her dog droppings and throwing them across the fence where they like to sit under the shade of the tree to eat their lunch. So I talked to this neighbor about it, and she says, well, I don't want my toddler playing in that stuff. Another time, I was going down the road, and I noticed back in near the back end of the field, there were three women out in the field picking beans. So that was kind of strange. I went back there and asked them, just what am I supposed to think of this? And they said, well, the realtor who sold us our house said that the first two rows in the field, on the edge of the field, belongs to the neighbors. I guess that's enough. Thank you.
Any questions?
I don't think so.
You know, this is common law. It happens to us all the time.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1187. We'll open a discussion on Senate Bill 1152. John Holman and Tim Kramer.
Okay.
I don't think the senators are going to follow. Maybe Tom Barrow. You want to get? You don't want to get testimony. Proceed.
Chairman Welch, committee members, my name is John Holloman. I am the executive director of Oregon Independent Miners. I want to thank you for this time to discuss with you the need for Senate Bill 1152. During the Senate committee hearings on this bill, a great deal of communications work between the miners of Oregon and the agencies directly involved with mining here in Oregon brought about the language you have before you now. The Division of State Lands, Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Geology and Mineral Resources has voiced their support during the Senate hearings. It is with great pleasure I report to you that state agencies and industry have come together in support of a management tool to help in the management of a valuable natural resource and a heritage that is truly Oregon. Senate Bill 1152 passed on the Senate floor, 28 A's, one excused, and one attending legislative business. This bill, while minimizing or stopping the Warner Creeks of mining, will be also preventive medicine. Small-scale and recreational miners today must deal with inadequate federal laws and protections. We have come to the point that we understand that self-protection is an absolute necessity. Our state laws, while adequate for homeowners and property owners, that deal with trespass do not address problems faced by the miner in the field. We need this bill to strengthen our law enforcement arsenal. Now, I said this was also preventive medicine. Included with our testimony is an email intercepted from both Earth First and a new organization called Gold Busters. These extreme organizations are determined to destroy the results of gold mining as it was done to logging and cattle. This email is full of deceitfully mistruths and fabricated misconceptions about an industry that has worked hard to develop environmentally sound practices. We must provide the means to protect a history and a heritage that is growing up with the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 1152 is a step towards recognizing the important heritage and economic benefits of small-scale and recreational mining. Small-scale independent mining dates back as far as Oregon's basis. It is a part of Oregon history that cannot be allowed to vanish. It is so much a part of Oregon heritage that is recognized in the state seal as the pickaxe. The first gold strikes in Oregon were in 1861, and the mines of Baker and Grant counties produced an estimated $20 million in 1862. Mining has grown up with the state of Oregon, and what it produces today can only be estimated. The annual output value of Oregon mines and natural gas wells averages more than $240 million today. Small-scale and recreational mining are important economic factors for both the state and local communities that border the mining districts. From Baker and Grant counties in eastern Oregon, the districts on the west side like Fortsville, Blue River, Fall Creek, Bohemia Mining District, to the Umpqua, to the southern Oregon districts, local communities spend on the dollars that mining brings in. Mining also brings in its fair share of tourist dollars to the state and local economies. Mining in our mining districts, both small-scale and recreational, are done so that impacts to habitat are beneficial to fish species and have the least possible environmental impacts. Small-scale and recreational mining must be regulated in the least burdensome manner possible so that mining can prosper. Small-scale and recreational mining must be protected from those who have extreme agendas, those that would block access, destroy equipment, and try to make mining look as if it was something it's not. I want to encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1152 forward. And again, I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Kramer. My name is Tim Kramer. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Oregon Independent Miners. First of all, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1152. I'll keep mine short and to the point since I know the hour is growing late. But first of all, I'd like to touch on a little bit of history. Oregon's heritage of small-scale mining goes back to the discovery of gold in Josephine Creek in Josephine County in 1850. Supplying the needs of these miners created Oregon's first stable economy. It took Oregon from a barter system to the monetary system we have today. Today's small-scale miners on a world, affecting the world's economy, according to Thomas Green in his book on worldwide mining, produce approximately 3 million ounces annually. Here in Oregon, small-scale and recreational mining touches virtually every aspect of our economy. It's not just the mining shops selling mining equipment that benefit, but automobile dealers selling vehicles to these people. For also camping gear, camp sleeping bags, shoes, clothing, groceries, just about anything you can think of. The small-scale and recreational miner does support that economy. Also, the importance of the small-scale miner's role in the economic development of the West is well recorded in that over 80% of all the major mines that were put into production were discovered by the small-scale miner and the lone prospector, which in turn created thousands of jobs, further enhancing the state's economy. But Oregon's heritage of mining did not come without a price, which was paid for by those willing to endure the hardships and, in some cases, even give their lives. That is why protection from groups such as Earth First, who have come forward with organizational plans for a splinter group called Gold Busters, whose sole purpose is to eliminate gold production in any form. This becomes a threat to the small-scale miners' rights, plus our heritage is in jeopardy. It is for these reasons that Senate Bill 1152 is so important. It protects this heritage and the rights our forefathers gave to us. Senate Bill 1152 would provide a deterrent to such groups for illegal acts such as mineral trespass, destruction of equipment and property, and denial of access. To let these groups destroy what our forefathers worked so hard to give us would not only be a travesty of justice, but a violation of our constitutional rights. Again, I would like to thank you, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Representative Atkinson.
Thank you. I realize the hour's late. I just have a couple of issues. I understand and grew up around mining and hobby mining, full-scale gold mining, and whatnot. I have a couple of questions, and my frame of reference is from a group called the New 49ers. You're both familiar with that group?
Okay.
my first question is the easiest one. How are your claims assigned, and does your group then have a policy against trespass?
Basically, Oregon Independent Miners is not set up like the 49ers. All of our members own their own claims. Basically, Oregon Independent Miners has associations belong to us. They're an umbrella group. We have individual members who own their own claims. And then we have some of the industry, the people that supply the equipment that belong to us. Basically, the people that are in Oregon, the miners in Oregon, all own their own claims. This is not a situation where we're looking at blanket claims.
Another question. Does your organization have a policy regarding a mining practice when you're in a river? Usually I've seen this with pretty big scale outfits where they will take river rock and to dig a hole, a dredge hole, and they put that river rock downstream. There was a policy, I enjoy a policy that puts it upstream, and the thought of that is that when the high river, high water comes, it pushes the rock back into the hole, as opposed to leaving holes all over the river. And I have almost been greatly injured several times walking in ankle-deep water and then finding myself over my head in fast-moving water. It's pretty scary stuff.
Sure.
Not to mention how it destroys riverbeds. So does your group have a policy on when rocks are taken? Do they go upstream or downstream?
Chairman Welch, Representative Atkinson. Basically, Oregon Independent Miners advocate agency policy. Now, we work with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, biologists. We work with the Division of State Lands. We work with the Department of Environmental Quality. And we work with the Department of Geology and Mineral Resources. We have all come together to develop that kind of policy. And we advocate what is mutually beneficial to both the miner and the environment. And that is what these agencies feel is necessary. Now, as for a particular rock being moved upstream or downstream, what the law says now is that rock will be returned back to the place it was taken out. And that's the law.
Question? Sure.
Question, Mercer.
I know that the recreational mining is quite different from commercial mining, but just to clarify for us, are either mercury or cyanide used in recreational mining?
Very, very, I would say zero. Chemical mining in the state is probably one of the most restrictive activities in the state. The state of Oregon has probably the best chemical mining laws of any state. No. If it is done, it's not done on stream. They take it home. And there's not much we can do over that.
Something further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really disturbed by the email that you brought forward, and I would hope that this group doesn't get far with their intent, especially the part about feminist activists turning in their goals. I don't intend to do that. It's probably the nature of recreational mining, as I understand it, that you have your own claim, you have your equipment, you have to leave it out there. You're not out there very often, or as often as you can get there, but just at the mercy of passers-by is what you're saying to people who have the intent of vandalizing it, and so that's your whole intent. Is to, what I need to ask is, what is the penalty for a Class C misdemeanor?
I looked it up the other night, Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor. I think a Class C misdemeanor is a $1,000 fine and 30 days in jail.
We don't chop off their hands or anything.
No. Mr. Chair?
Okay, true. As I hear that we are under a call, I move Senate Bill 1152 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay, true. Move Senate Bill 1152 to the floor to do pass recommendation. If you check the vote, and the Senate side was unanimous and very positive.
I do have one problem with one sentence of this bill, and that is the part in section 2, subsection 3 about prospecting small-scale mining being beneficial to fish. And while I agree with everything else in this bill, that's it. I unfortunately cannot agree with that.
Chairman Welch, Representative Tabori, that actual sentence came from ODFW. They supported removing significant out of the word significant out of that. Once it was removed, the biologists at ODFW were in complete support.
Mr. Chair, I support the bill. Put rocks upstream. That's
not right.
I'm a vehement little supporter of putting rocks in.
Okay. The clerk, please follow the vote.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Atkinson is carried. Thank you very much. Okay. We close our work session on Senate Bill 1152 and we adjourn for the day.